Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Gabe Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Hi, welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson. This week, Congress approved a budget deal that will increase spending by $80 billion over 2 years. It also suspends the federal debt ceiling until 2017, which allows the Treasury Department to borrow whatever it needs to meet its financial obligations and avoid a government default. Now, the House approved this on Wednesday, 266 to 167, and then the Senate followed along 64 to 35. So it looks like we have some bipartisanship in Congress. What do you think, Jay?
I think it's a good thing. Again, you know me, Mike. So often I talk about ideology is important, but tactics are important too. And pushing another debt ceiling fight, fiscal cliff type situation, that sort of brinksmanship, it just Republicans never win.
And I think a lot of people in the public don't really understand what the whole debt ceiling issue is all about. It's not actually about giving the Treasury Department the authority to spend additional money or more money. It's just basically giving the Treasury Department the authority to borrow money to pay the bills we already have that have come in.
Correct. Yeah. And it's one of those things that it is something that has to get done essentially just because of the way things are set up. So it provides a convenient pressure point look, if you want something that you want to have to get done, that you threaten up to hold that up. I mean, it's sort of you, threatening to shut off the power there.
Right, which is what the Freedom Caucus types have been doing for the last few years now with these debt ceiling negotiations.
Now, I would say that, you know, it was the Republicans did achieve some moderate success on that type of tactic a couple years ago. And it was, I don't know if I want to say it was necessarily a Republican victory, but it was sort of the Obama, you know, came up with them with the sequester plan, and the Republicans called him on the bluff and said, okay, let's go ahead and sequester.
Right.
And again, at the time, everyone was told that the world would likely end soon because of the sequester. People would be dying in the streets and so forth, and no one did. And now Obama has since been crowing about, the lowest or the reduction in the federal deficit. I don't want to say the brinksmanship never works. I should backtrack on that. But historically, this kind of threatening to shut stuff down never works for Republicans, and I'm glad they're sort of learning their lesson here.
Yeah, and $80 billion sounds like a lot, but $80 billion over 2 years is not really – it's small change when it comes to the federal budget, certainly. And it is actually going to be offset. That's not new spending. It's going to be offset by Medicare cuts to providers. We'll see if that happens. Cuts in Social Security disability benefits. And also, finally, we're going to look to start selling some of the oil in our Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not really that I don't think it's that big of a deal in the dollars and cents, significance. But in terms of actually being able to get something done and not have to have this fight for the next couple of years, that I think is a good thing. Though to me, probably the best part of this whole deal is that it renames the rotunda outside of the speaker's office Freedom Foyer. Little known fact.
I didn't know that.
And also it calls for permanent display of John Boehner's favorite busts. You probably didn't even know that John Boehner had favorite busts.
I don't even know which favorite busts are his favorites.
I will tell you. Of course I will tell you. Winston Churchill, a classic.
I like that. All right.
Okay. Václav Havel.
Another. All right. I'm on board with that.
And then Lajos Kossuth.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently he was a Hungarian.
I know who Lajos Kossuth is.
Okay, I didn't. I had no clue. He seemed like one of these things is not like the other. You know, he was big and hungry, I suppose.
Right.
In
1848. And I believe, was he someone, did he help us in the revolution?
He may well have. I have no clue. Let's say he did in some revolution. He helped us. I think so, because he was that kind of guy. Larry.
And I think there may be a statue of him down on like around East 105th.
Well, there's,
if I'm correct, if it's the right guy I'm thinking of. And when I was in Columbus, I lived on Kossuth Street for a couple of years.
Wow, I had no idea there was a Kossuth connection here.
That's so, yeah.
Amazing, small world. So, but yeah, I think this is it's a sign that Congress isn't entirely dysfunctional all the time, though, of course, it required the outgoing Speaker Boehner to actually get more, to rely more on Democratic votes than Republican votes in the House. And,
right. But here's the thing. You always, if you're a good speaker, you know what the numbers are, and you know which of your members can take a walk, and he did, and you still were able to get it done. So I think that's a good sign.
Yeah. Well, and certainly most people would agree with that. I think the only people who really have an issue are the Freedom Caucus members who are calling it the zombie budget. And very unhappy with any kind of spending increases, I think, and felt that it was John Boehner maybe thumbing his nose at them on the way out the door, which I don't know that that's necessarily untrue. I feel like they deserve to have noses thumbed and other things thumbed at them anyway. So yeah, I think that was some, it's nice to report on some, you know, on some positive things that Congress actually manages to get done despite the Freedom Caucus.
Well, I would, you know, qualify. There's a lot of stuff that Congress does get done that just doesn't get reported.
That's true, but it's generally not this big.
That can be a topic for another day. I mean, sort of we've had this conversation before, like with the Supreme Court, where, you know, the vast majority of their decisions are unanimous or almost unanimous. I mean, something like 80%. And they're just on topics or issues of law that don't arouse the public controversy. And the same thing goes for Congress. There are plenty of good pieces of legislation and a lot of things that are just sort of fluff that go through.
Fluff.
But I suppose are important to somebody that pass with, you know, pretty easily, pretty significant bipartisan majorities. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to something where there isn't necessarily as much consensus, a much bigger story this week. I would argue it's a bigger story, but far less important. And that was, of course, that on Wednesday, the top 10 Republican candidates for their party's nomination for president met in Boulder, Colorado at an event that was moderated and broadcast by CNBC. Did you watch the debate, Jay?
I did not. Okay. So, you know, look, you got to take what I say with that grain of salt. And it wasn't because I was a bad Republican or a bad American that I didn't watch. I just had other stuff going on.
It was game two of the World Series, wasn't it, at the same time?
Well, there was that, and we had some children theatrical activities, I actually had, again, as a Republican, I got to work to support everybody else here. So,
well,
you know.
It amazed me that actually the debate had got better numbers than Game 2 of the World Series, which I wouldn't have expected. In fact, it was the highest rated show ever on CNBC, I believe.
Well, that's not a big
CNBC, but still they outdrew the World Series, you know? So there's something to be said for that, although the numbers were a lot smaller than the first two debates that Trump was sort of being in, you know, full Trump mode. But it seems like the general consensus is that Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio won and Jeb Bush is more or less on life support here.
That's my understanding. And I again, not having seen it, what I understand is Jeb Bush was very much the, you know, sort of gaffe prone as he's tended to be, as other members of his family have tended to be. Cruz and Rubio really shine, which, you know, again, I think I don't know if I've put my cards on the table here as far as, look, I'm probably mostly a Rubio guy. I think that's sort of how people thought things would start to pan out.
Well, right now the markets,
I guess the Cruz bit is perhaps more surprising, but,
well, Cruz isn't going anywhere because he bumps into a natural ceiling of, there are only so many crazy people, even in the Republican Party, and so I think he bottoms out or tops out pretty quickly. But right now, the prediction markets really like Rubio. The PredictWise has him at a 41% chance of getting the nomination, followed by Trump at 19%, and then Jeb Bush all the way down there at 11%. So That seems to be more or less the consensus. And, you know, one person who is almost certainly isn't going to get the nomination, it's really too bad in a sense, is my governor and your governor, John Kasich, who right now supposedly has around a 2% chance. I don't even know if it's quite that high, but he's really come out in the last week or so as trying to be the adult in the room, the voice of reason. And that's of course a losing strategy, particularly in a primary race. I mean, my God, what's he thinking? But I admire him for that. I'm pleased with, you know, what he said, basically that the things that a lot of these his fellow Republicans are calling for are essentially insane. And they're just saying crazy stuff to try to stand out and get the nomination. And apparently getting the nomination is not what John Kasich's all about, I guess.
Well, I've said this before. I am a big Kasich fan, and he calls it like he sees it and tells it like he is. And hats off to him for doing that.
Absolutely.
You know, and we'll see how this actually comes out, because, again, national polls don't really mean anything at this point until someone actually starts voting. And last I checked, he's still in good shape in New Hampshire. I don't know what his situation is in Iowa. But as we've said, Iowa's always a little... it's very peculiar and really unto itself, and New Hampshire and South Carolina sort of really are the real first primary states.
Right. And I think also that the very structure of the debates this year, or the structure of the field, I guess, this year, with that many candidates, essentially the incentive is to be more wild and more crazy, to just try to find some way to stand out. And Kasich is trying an unusual tactic, standing out by being sane. And actually, it does make him stand out quite a lot. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to work for him. And it's really too bad, because I would like, in an ideal world, I'd like to see him as the Republican nominee. But now the other part of the debate, the thing that the media went crazy about in part, was the job that CNBC's moderators did. And the Republican Party is not happy with CNBC's moderators either, feeling that they asked too many gotcha questions.
Well, I mean, I guess what would one expect of CNBC? I can tell you, I think that the network is sort of inherently dishonest and disingenuous.
Wow.
What do you expect?
Unlike Fox News.
Well, no, I think if you look at the questions that Fox News asked in its debate, there were a lot of tough questions, a lot of gotcha kind of questions, but it wasn't the built-in ideological bias. And again, I can't comment a whole lot because I didn't watch the coverage. What I've just done is, you know, read what other people who have watched the coverage have said about it. Right. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. It's secondhand, but...
I think there's a distinction to be made between a tough question and a gotcha question. And at least in theory, the candidates don't object to tough questions. They'd rather not have them, obviously. But it's the gotcha questions. And I mean, there's a pretty strong consensus that the CNBC moderators did a really bad job, actually. And so, I don't know, I feel like even if they did a wonderful job, when you have 10 people on the stage, that you're not going to get anything that resembles more than a collection of sound bites. And, you know, and so that's why these debates, that's why they weren't the lead story in our show this week, because I think it's a lot of sound if you're in fury signifying very little. You know, there's a there's a concept that two political scientists, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, talk about. They say, you know, there's this distinction between what they call politics as electoral spectacle and politics as organized combat. An electoral spectacle is all this stuff, like this debate stuff, that in the end doesn't mean much, but it's dramatic, and, you know, and people love to talk about it and that sort of thing. What really matters is what happens in the trenches, particularly between the elections, and that stuff's so incredibly boring to most folks, except that's what it's all about, you know. And so to me, that this just drives me nuts. So all the articles I had to wade through this week that were just so much BS and so much worthless waste of ink and space. Not really ink, obviously, it's online, but still, just debates. I hate debates so much. I really am not a debate guy. I'll watch. I'll seriously, when it gets down to the final.
How do you feel about conventions?
God, conventions. Oh, God, yeah, no kidding. Don't even start me at conventions. Even worse, God, that just that political theater stuff drives me absolutely just batshit. Oh, yeah, I hate that stuff. Anyway,
no, I would say, look, I think there's a really good point to be made there. I'd never put it in those contexts because I'm not an actual professional political scientist. But yeah, there is the real policy work, I guess, and some of the real building on coalition building and so forth to get your guy elected and actually get people out to vote. And there is this showbiz aspect to it. And it's almost like the people who are professionals in this, it's almost like someone in Hollywood, I mean, who makes movies and they sort of know all the special effects tricks that go into it and so forth. And as such, maybe you enjoy the movie a little less. It's kind of like watching a magic trick. If you know how they do it, I guess Maybe it's a little less fun.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. It's certainly not a lot of fun for me.
But I think to the credit of the electorate, I think a lot of people build that in to things like debates and conventions.
Really?
Is that you know to a certain extent that there's sort of a willing suspension of disbelief, right? I mean, it's you know that it's sort of a performance. It's sound bitten. I'm not sure the best way to put that.
I wonder if people really, you know, sometimes I think that those of us who are deeply involved in politics tend to think that others analyze these things more than perhaps they do. But I don't know. But
and then you get to these situations where, I mean, and what is interesting is when you get that rare, very honest, authentic moment, I guess.
Authentic moment? Do we get those? Okay.
Well, you do rarely. And the weird thing, of course, is there's the big incentive to try to create the inauthentic moment or to make it look authentic. And that's what I guess people look for in debates, is that there's, you know, something is actually going to pop up and there's going to be the great comeback or something.
Yeah. And someone's going to screw up and say what they mean. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But
yeah. Yeah, I don't think we've seen a whole lot of authenticity or a whole lot of substance. I think that their handlers warned them against those sort of things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because there's typically more risk than reward in it.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, without a doubt. So yeah, the Republican debate, don't think it changes a whole lot, though. The one big thing is that there seemed to be a consensus view that if Jeb Bush were to bring his campaign out of the doldrums, he would have had to have done something special at that debate, and he didn't. And now it looks really, really bad for Bush's campaign. All right, let's moving on. On Thursday, 45-year-old Paul Ryan became the 54th Speaker of the House, making him the youngest person to hold the position since, Jay, do you know?
Oh,
James.
Man, I wasn't expecting
that. I know. I threw that at you. My God, what's wrong with me? Okay.
Oh, man. Was John Adams ever Speaker of the House?
You know,
John Quincy Adams.
I don't know. He might have been, but actually it's James Blaine.
Oh.
James Blaine in 1869. Blaine was 39 when he got the job. Blaine was also Secretary of State twice. You know, but a very accomplished kind of guy. Anyway,
what the hell are we doing?
I don't, you know, yeah, really, it's sort of depressing when you think about that. But anyway, Ryan takes over, of course, from John Boehner, a man old enough to be his father, just barely. But this is kind of I don't know how big of a deal it is exactly, though. John Boehner and Paul Ryan are very different kind of guys, aside from their age, certainly. Paul Ryan has long been known of as the Republican idea guy, hasn't he?
Yeah, really sort of the heir to like I say, a Jack Kemp or someone like that who is much more policy focused.
Yeah, and Jack Kemp was, in fact, one of his mentors, and he was coming up because Ryan has been in office for quite a while. He first got into the House when he was 28 years old, so he's an old, you know, even though he's just kind of early middle-aged, he's still been in Congress for quite a long time.
Yep.
And Jack Kemp was sort of, I think, someone that both you and I looked up to when we were kind of coming up. in a way.
Yeah, very
kind
much
of a
so.
Policy guy, an ideas guy, not at all insane, which is nice. You know, I kind of appreciate that in a Republican, so in anyone really. So yeah, I think he started off by saying, well, you know, the House is broken. We're not solving problems. We're adding to them. And I thought, well, okay, that's a good beginning. And then he also said that, in referring to the Freedom Caucus, that a neglected minority will gum up the works and a respected minority will work in good faith. Now, I agree with half of that statement.
which half?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that, yeah, if you neglect the Freedom Caucus, they will attempt to gum up the works. But I don't think for a minute, and I don't think Paul Ryan thinks for a minute, that if he pretends to respect the Freedom Caucus, that they'll work in good faith. Unless by good faith you mean give us everything we want and we're going to throw a massive tantrum and try our best to shut down the government.
I don't have enough insight into what the Freedom Caucus members actually think and how they actually work. And I think it's one of those, it's, you know, when you have a big collective group, there are going to be some people who think one thing and some another. So it's tough to just put one label and say this is how this organization is going to act when it's a bunch of individuals. You know, so it's likely there may be some who will work in good faith and there are likely some who won't. You know, but the Freedom Caucus can also serve a valuable role to the new speaker, and that is to sort of be the ideological anchors, if you will.
Yeah. More ways than one. Okay.
Well, no, but, you know, look, you can have some folks who are always, you know, back in the Ohio House in back in the day. We had a couple representatives, one in particular, who in his entire career voted for one budget, I think, and that really took some doing because there was just sort of the, you know, idea of, look, the government shouldn't spend any money, period.
Right.
But he also made the point at every budget cycle, where he would talk about, here's where the budget started years ago, here's where we are now. And show that there has never been any real reduction in spending. Spending has always increased. It's always been a one-way street. And I think that's important to have, that reminder out there, to give pause to others. Now, you can do that without gumming up the works. And that's really sort of the art form. And it's also part of being the speaker is, like we said a little bit earlier, being able to get enough votes to get stuff done,
right,
and still allowing those people to express either their conscience or say what they need to say to defend off a primary.
Yeah.
Again, that can vary from member to member.
Yeah, I don't know that.
But I think that's the real test of leadership is being able to get those people you know, be able to be a, I'm just stumbling today. I'm sorry. Sort of a loyal opposition.
Yeah. And I don't know that Paul Ryan's going to be any more effective than John Boehner was in this. Now he has a little more credibility in the sense that he's somewhat slightly more conservative than Boehner, but I don't really think that a lot of the people at the far right wing of the party really care about a little more conservative. So I don't know that that helps him a whole lot. And I don't know what, well, we'll find out what sort of leadership skills he has. I mean, it's not where he made a name for himself. Certainly he wasn't really on that ladder. He didn't even really want the job, but, so I don't know that things are going to change a whole lot, but, he's got,
let me put out one bright little, patch here that, you say maybe doesn't have a lot of leadership skills yet or hasn't demonstrated them. His election was virtually uncontested. There were some Freedom Caucus stalwarts,
right,
who voted against it, but there was no serious leadership fight.
Right.
And that's significant. And I think that bodes well.
Well, I hope so, certainly, because I think that to the extent that he can sort of calm that far right wing down, we might actually see at least a little more productivity out of Congress, or at least out of the House, and that would be a good thing, I think. So I wish him well, absolutely, you know. Okay, moving on to foreign policy. We hadn't talked about foreign policy yet this week, but there was some news on Wednesday when Iran accepted Russia's invitation to attend a new round of negotiations along with the U.S. and Saudi Arabia over how to resolve the war in Syria. Now, of course, we've talked about the war in Syria a number of times, been going on since 2011, over 250,000 people killed, and the largest refugee crisis since World War II. So some pretty serious business. And this represents a pretty big change because Russia wouldn't have extended this invitation if the U.S. hadn't withdrawn our objections to it. And we've so in the past have been very much against Syria, or sorry, very much against Iran being part of these talks. So do you think this represents some kind of a new opening, diplomatic opening with Iran? Or what do you think, Jay?
No, I think it's quite the opposite. I think it's the Iranians and the Russians are now seeking to solidify the gains that they have made and sort of solidify essentially the Russian influence in Syria. You know, I think the U.S. is in large part out of the game at this point. You know, it's going to be a matter of supporting. I'm betting the Russian-Iranian solution is going to be something like, let's just support Assad.
Right. Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I think the U.S. is kind of coming around.
I mean, this is, you know, Russians particularly do this all the time where, you know, look, you invade Ukraine and you, then people start firing back. And so you take over the country and then you call for a ceasefire.
Right.
That's not uncommon, and I think this is a little bit like that. Is they've sort of asserted their I don't think hegemony is the word because it's not that.
Their badassery in this region,
yeah, in Syria. And look, we'll say they haven't won yet. They're still fighting ISIS, but you know, look, the two forces there are the Russian Iranian Assad
right.
faction and ISIS. There's really no U.S.
Not until now, because that leads right into a second bit of news on that. On Friday, President Obama mentioned it in passing. It was a formal announcement. Hey, by the way, he announced that he'd ordered several dozen special operations troops into Syria in an advisory capacity. Now, that's in a way, obviously, that's not a big deal. Just a couple dozen. But they're the first,
to advise the 50 rebels that we've trained.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we're not exactly matching up really well. And it's a weird kind of thing because
it's sort of like every rebel is going to get their own personal trainer, sort of.
It's a nice ratio, I suppose. Yeah, but I guess it's it's symbolic in the sense that we actually have some troops on the ground there, even though they're not combat troops. And thank God they're not combat troops there. But yeah, I think I agree with you on this, that this is kind of Russia's and Iran's thing. And I think we're coming around to the fact, unfortunate as it is, that we're not going to get what we want in this region because we're not willing to do the things that we need to do to get what we want. And that would be putting real troops on the ground and putting some real force into play. And that's just not on the table.
Well, and more so, I think most people would realize that to do that would risk some really serious consequences.
Yeah.
Because look, we're not fighting on the same side as the Russians.
Not exactly.
And for us to put any sort of bigger military presence in there risks either accidental or intentional inflammation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't see what these advisors will do. I think if this had been done maybe, 3 years ago, this might be a different situation.
Yeah. But
it wasn't, and we are where we are.
Yep, absolutely. Not a great place, but there it is. I thought it was interesting on the Iranian side of things that just a few weeks ago, in fact, their top Ayatollah, I forget the guy's name, Khamenei, said that any new talks with the U.S. were forbidden. And so they kind of finessed this by saying, oh, we meant bilateral talks, multilateral talks with the U.S. are perfectly okay. So it's nice to see that even the Ayatollahs have, you know, spin doctors working for them and so forth.
Well, and, you know, I think that just goes to show, and this is something you and I agree on, the Obama foreign policy in the Middle East has just been a disaster. And, you know, the Iranians are as of a month or so ago, I mean, we were talking about them as sort of our partners in peace here.
Sort of, okay,
As they continue to, you know, test missiles that will carry the nuclear weapons that they're not building. You know, so, I think the... I don't know have any solution for this, and I don't know that anyone does. So.
Not John Kerry, and not Barack Obama, and no one that I know of either. So, well, you know, I think Vladimir Putin has a solution to it, but it's not really the solution that we want. So,
well, you know, maybe the first thing that we ought to do, and Obama ought to do, and Kerry ought to do, is stop calling this all these things sort of a victory. You know what I mean? It's sort of the... you know, maybe the first thing is to face reality. Say, look, we've been snookered here, and we need to recognize that, and maybe then take a better realistic view of what we would like to see in the Middle East, and then what our capabilities are to realize those goals.
I think at that point, I think that has about a 0% chance of happening, but I think it does have a good chance of happening when the next president comes in and puts in his or her own Secretary of State. So
have to be a reexamination.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one final thing I wanted to talk about this week, a big development in the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Elevated Netted Sensor System.
Okay.
JLENS.
What's going on with that?
Oh, JLENS had big problems this week. Now, you might have heard of it as the Big Blimp. Actually, that's the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Elevated Netted Sensor System. You heard about the Big Blimp, yeah?
I did hear about the Big Blimp.
Yeah, the Big Blimp.
I had no idea that that's what we used it for, the attack missile.
It is an elevated netted sensor system. I guess the Blimp would be the elevated part, yeah. And, of course, the Blimp came loose on Wednesday and wreaked havoc, as reports have it, as the cable that was supposed to hold it down apparently took out a lot of power for many people. It is, according to the manufacturer, a super strong cable, but apparently not... Not
well,
super strong.
People, when you're buying the military, they look at the specs of what kind of cable they need, and super strong.
Yeah, of course. No, we can get strong. We can get super strong. I'll get the super strong. Yeah, I think they need the super duper strong, apparently. From what I understand, they still haven't figured out exactly why the super strong cable failed or what exactly happened. Although the next day, there was a lot of fun for the Pennsylvania State Police, who got a chance to visit the Blimp and deflate it by shooting shotguns at it. Which apparently is the approved.
That's awesome for so many reasons.
You know, it really is. It's the approved JLENS.
Although shotguns,
deflation.
Even, I would think.
A lot of pellets.
Something more. Yeah, well, I think you'd want more like a rifle, though, kind of just I don't know. It depends on how high the thing is, I suppose.
I would have just thought you walk up to it with a box cutter and just, you know, but apparently the skin is maybe a little thicker than that. But I wish maybe someone did video that. I would like to see that. I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere. But yeah, it's part of a $2.8 billion Army program that apparently has suffered some setbacks now. It's really good if your blimps actually stay where they're supposed to go. So yeah, we wish the best for the JLENS program. At least I do. But we hope they can get their super strong cables back in operation sometime soon. You know,
absolutely. So. And in the meantime, thank God that we are protected by those law enforcement officers and the citizens, well-armed citizenry, who could have come out to shoot down the Blimp if needed.
A victory for the Second Amendment, certainly. Okay.
Yep.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, or criticisms, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. That's politicsguys@gmail.com. If you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, we'd really appreciate it if you could take a minute to rate the show and write a quick review. The Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.